5 Israeli occupation forces from Gaza dies due to mistreatment and torture in the occupation regime's jails. The United Nations Security Council approves a resolution calling for a swift end to the war in Ukraine, with the U.S. and Russia hailing the move as a significant step toward peace. Hello everyone and welcome to World News. Our top story, Iran's Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf says the presence of massive crowds at the funeral of Hezbollah's martyred leaders was a testament to the resistance movement's unbreakable popular support. Ghalibaf praised the power and unity of Hezbollah, stressing that the resistance and commitment to Lebanon's security makes it impossible for enemies to eliminate the movement from the country's political and security landscape. Highlighting Hezbollah's defense against Israeli aggression, he noted the movement's role in maintaining Lebanon's sovereignty. In the past 2 days, there were funeral and burial ceremonies for Nasrallah and another Hezbollah leader, Sayyid Hashem Safieddine, in Lebanon. The two were assassinated by Israel in separate airstrikes months back. Catastrophic humanitarian conditions in Gaza continue to claim more civilian lives amid repeated Israeli violations of the ceasefire with Hamas. Now, according to medical sources, three newborn babies froze to death Monday due to severe cold and lack of proper shelter. Babies who were less than 2 months old lived in displacement tents in Gaza City with zero heating. Meanwhile, Israeli forces continue violating the truce by targeting Palestinian civilians and their homes in a number of areas, including Al-Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City. Earlier, regime warplanes bombed the southern city of Rafah twice in less than an hour. According to health officials, 5 bodies were recovered from under the rubble, while 2 Palestinians died from previous wounds. This brings the death toll from U.S.-Israeli genocide since October of 2023 to over 48,300, with nearly 112,000 Palestinians injured. Among the numerous infrastructure targeted by the Israeli regime during its genocidal campaign is the cultural center in Gaza City. The center served as a vital place for Palestinians' gatherings, hosting various cultural and social ceremonies. Our Gaza correspondent, Ghada Ibrahim, has visited the site for this report.
The more we walk and move across the popular streets of Gaza City, the more destruction unfolds. This place behind me is Rashad Shawa Cultural Center. This place has been the inspiring hub of culture and educational gatherings in Gaza. Many art exhibitions, film screenings, and even school graduations were held here. This was a place full of life, youth energy, and inspiration. The Israeli bombs decided in November 2023 to mutilate it and to brutally turn it into wreckage and ruins.
The Israeli occupation targeted everything during its war on Gaza, everything literally. All the international institutions, healthcare institutions, and the cultural institutions were deliberately targeted by the Israeli bombs. This Israeli occupation wanted to obliterate the Palestinian identity. However, it cannot be erased from the hearts of our people.
The destruction of such a place asserts the idea that the Israeli regime is aiming at annihilating the Palestinian society with all its factions and social layers. It also aims at defacing the beautiful sites engraved in the Palestinian collective memory to punish the coming generations as well as the past generations without any military purpose, but just for destruction. The bombing and the destruction of Rashad Shawa Cultural Center, alongside with dozens of cultural centers across the Gaza City, cannot be separated from the broader context of the Israeli objectives of the war, which is to destroy Gaza with all its culture and social pillars and to kill any aspect of life for the Gazans. Ghada Ibrahim, Gaza City.
Another Palestinian abducted by the Israeli forces from Gaza has died due to mistreatment and torture by Israeli forces in the occupation jails. 2 Palestinian prisoners' rights bodies slammed the death of 35-year-old Musab Hanihaniyeh, who was the father of a 9-year-old child, is that Hania was not suffering from any health issues before his detention. Hania's death has increased the number of Palestinian abductees that have died from systematic torture in the regime prison since the onset of Israel's genocide in Gaza to 59 now. At least 38 of the fatalities are related to Palestinians abducted from Gaza. The rights bodies have voiced grave concern over the dangerous upsurge in number of Palestinians dying in Israeli custody. They said thousands of civilians are still languishing in Israeli imprisonment and subjected to torture, starvation, medical neglect, and contagious diseases. Political analyst Sakina Datu joined us earlier with her thoughts on the story. She says the mistreatment to Palestinian abductees in the regime's jails is against normal human behavior.
This is not just to say in the context of because, you know, the Zionists are perpetrating these tortures against Palestinians, but genuinely, psychologically, if you study not just those in power and those in the IDF and IOF forces, but general local population, anyone who lives in Israel, at least the majority of them, their mentality and their psychology is really deranged. And there's a lot of discussion happening about, you know, what is it that makes people these kind of things? It's not a human trait. A normal human being has got a conscience within themselves. And it is not a common human factor to be conducting this kind of atrocities on another people. The fact that, you know, the population would defend something like rape of prisoners just tells you this society is really, really sick. I think what is missing, the missing link, is that the people are aware of the fact that the Zionists are really demonic people, but there isn't yet a system. People haven't found a way to take action against them. But sooner or later, this will happen because this kind of a society really cannot exist. If not from outside, they will implode from within because all the characteristics of these people are really sickening.
The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has condemned Israel's decision to deny entry to two European Parliament members, calling it outrageous. The ministry described the move as a calculated attempt to prevent officials from witnessing Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. Rima Hassan and Lynn Boylan were expelled upon arrival at the Tel Aviv airport while part of an official EU delegation. The ministry said Israel must face consequences for its actions, calling on the European Union to respond decisively. Israel said it barred Hassan because she'd been promoting boycotts against the regime. The UN Security Council has adopted a resolution calling for a swift end to the Ukraine conflict as the U.S. pushes ahead with its peace initiative with Russia. Now, the U.S. drafted text was adopted with 10 votes in favor, while France, Britain, Denmark, Greece, and Slovenia abstained. This is the first resolution of the Security Council that's been able to be adopted in over 3 years on Ukraine, as previous resolutions were vetoed by Moscow. Now, although European members of the Security Council did not veto the resolution, they criticized it for being too lenient on Moscow. On the other hand, countries such as China, Russia, and the U.S. have welcomed the resolution.
The United States sincerely appreciates Council members' support for this resolution and applauds the action, the first this Council has taken in 3 years on Ukraine, to firmly call for an end to the conflict. This resolution puts us on the path to peace. It is a first step, but a crucial one.
We can see this text as just a starting point for future efforts towards a peaceful settlement here. They will not be successful unless a constructive cooperation of key world players on the issues of European and international security is restored. The outline of that can already be seen in the American text, and this gives us certain optimism.
This resolution marks the latest round of efforts to push for a peaceful negotiation towards ending the war in Ukraine, following the recent rapprochement between Moscow and Washington. This shift in U.S. policy, however, has created a rift with European allies who view the Ukraine issue as an integral part of their national security. Moscow has repeatedly said the only way to end the war in Ukraine is through talks. Joining us now out of Brussels is Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst. Hello, Mr. Doctorow, good to check in with you. Always a pleasure. And now, Gilbert, your initial thoughts on this, can we call it a monumental shift in U.S. policy in dealing with the Moscow and Kiev?
Yes, it is a sea change. It was something that could not be anticipated. And, of course, it has left Europeans reeling, running around like headless chickens, as one of their spokesmen said today, hoping to bring them together for a common position, because there is no common position accepted by all of the EU member states. By most of them, yes, but by all of them, no. The important thing I would like to call out is that there were two votes yesterday. One was the one that you have featured, which is dramatic, and that the United States text was passed by the Security Council, and this text is calling for an urgent foreign aid peace as quickly as possible, and is not laying blame at Russia's door, which has been the case in all communications that have passed through the United Nations since the start of a special military operation. The second vote which went on, which is that was in the General Assembly of the United Nations, and that where, in that place, the traditional litany of Russia's offenses, its need that calling it the aggressor, saying that it had to withdraw from Ukrainian territory, all of this ritual, a denunciation of Russia, which has gone on for the last 3 years, was repeated, was approved by a majority, although there were a great number of abstentions. The point here is that your very remark on the rift, on the chasm, I would call it, in positions between the United States and Europe, is highlighted by these two different votes. Europe, when given the chance to bring in all of its own vassals who could support its initiative, voted for war, and in the Security Council, Europe abstained and let the American initiative pass for the first time in the dealings with the Russia-Ukraine war in the Security Council. This is remarkable.
Right, and all the billions of dollars, all the billions in weapons, they have not given Ukraine, Dr. O, the upper hand in this conflict, or even come close to changing the fate of the ultimate outcome of this conflict. I mean, it seems like the current White House, this administration with Donald Trump, is taking the most pragmatic and practical approach. This does not mean that he loves the Russians. He's siding the Russians. They're now his number one ally. He's just basically accepting the facts on the ground that they're just basically throwing a lot of money away and causing a lot of death and destruction in Ukraine.
It's very difficult to take a definitive reading of Donald Trump. He is throwing a lot of balls into the air. Some of them are coming down to the ground. Some of them are being caught. And it's hard to say what is a genuine statement by Trump, where he wants to go, and what is a tactical statement to try to entrap the people whom he is dealing with. I say that because yesterday there was another development, a very important one. That was the meeting between Emmanuel Macron and Donald Trump in the White House, which ended in a press conference at which it seemed that they had total rapport, or almost total rapport, with respect to the outcome of the war in Ukraine and the introduction of European peacemakers. Now, this is, frankly speaking, running against the intent of Trump to end the war with the Russians, because unless there's something agreed that we don't know about, the Russians are dead set against having any international peacekeepers in Ukraine after the war is settled. They don't want any soldiers of any kind from outside Ukraine to be there. Well, you know what happened the last time in Minsk II Accords, when there were OSCE monitors watching the peace. Those monitors were standing there watching when the Ukrainians were firing artillery shells and missiles into the residential neighborhoods of the nearby Donbas Russian-speaking provinces that were rebelling against rule from Kiev. There were civilians killed, 14,000 civilians killed over the course of 8 years, from 2014, when the Minsk Accords were introduced, to 2022, when the Russians started their special military operation. Now, the notion that Macron is projecting is essentially condemnatory to Russia. It is saying that Russia will not keep the peace. Russia is a recidivist aggressor and will seek to renew the war and move to Europe if it is not held back by a deterrent force, meaning these Europeans. That is not a good basis to conclude a peace, and it runs in the face of the position taken by the United States today.
All right, thank you. Stay safe. Always a pleasure checking with you from Brussels. Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, Independent International Affairs Analyst there joining us. International Criminal Court Prosecutor Karim Khan has appealed for armed groups in East Congo to abide by international laws fighting spreads in the mineral-rich region.
The law must be seen to be effective. All individuals must comply with the Rome Statute. Nobody can attack civilians, hurt people, kill people. And this is a moment where we will see if international criminal law can withstand the demands that the people of the Democratic Republic of Congo insist upon, which is the equal application of the law.
Et c'est là, c'est l'application équitable de la loi.
Khan said the ICC extends a hand of cooperation with the government of the DRC to bring in other partners to try to make a sustainable approach to justice. Some 7,000 people have died since January as army and allied groups battled Rwanda-backed M23 rebels. Rwanda says it's defending itself against the threat from Hutu militia, which it says are fighting alongside the Congolese military. The M23 offensive is the gravest escalation in more than a decade of the long-running conflict in the East Congo, rooted in the spillover of Rwanda's 1994 genocide into Congo and the struggle for control of Congo's vast mineral resources. That's a wrap for your latest. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, I'll be speaking to a man that has dedicated his academic career to the experiences of the Irish diaspora in England during the conflict. At its height, the fraught relationship between the British and Irish communities saw a number of high-profile miscarriages of justice perpetuated against Irish citizens, something that today's guest will discuss in detail. But before we do, let's get a quick overview on this week's topic.
Ireland is globally renowned for its diaspora. Most notable are the Irish immigrants that provided the labour for thriving Western economies in the United States, Canada, Australia, and our nearest neighbour, Britain. Whether it was the 10,000 Irishmen that built the Transcontinental Railroad in the US or the famous Donegal Tunnel Taggers that constructed the many underground tunnels around Britain, many of whom died under horrific conditions, the Irish have, for the most part, assimilated and been welcomed with open arms by their host countries. However, there were notable exceptions. During the IRA's English bombing operations in the 1970s, a sea change in public opinion, shaped by a ferocious media campaign, unearthed old stereotypes of the past. In the aftermath of the Birmingham pub bombings that killed 21 people, the Prevention of Terrorism Act was introduced by the British government. This legislation provided widespread cover for many miscarriages of justice, most notably the imprisonment of the Birmingham 6, Guildford 4, and Maguire 7. In the case of the Birmingham trials, six Irishmen were each sentenced to life imprisonment in 1975 following their false convictions for the 1974 Birmingham pub bombings. Their convictions were declared unsafe and unsatisfactory and quashed by the Court of Appeal on the 14th of March 1991. Similarly, in the case of the Guildford 4 and Maguire 7, 11 people, mostly Irish, were wrongly convicted in 1975 and 1976 for the Guildford pub bombings in October 1974 and the Woolwich pub bombing a month later. All the convictions were eventually quashed after long campaigns for justice, and the cases, along with those of the Birmingham 6, diminished public confidence in the integrity of the English criminal justice system. 5 decades later, and the label of suspect community has fallen on the Muslim population of Britain. The deployment of negative stereotyping, intelligence profiling, and wrongful arrests are just some of the many abuses of power being applied by government agencies with convenient cover from broadcast media. Islamophobia is being augmented by Israeli and far-right US money in order to drive a wedge between communities in Britain that see the current US-Israeli genocide in Palestine as one of the great humanitarian catastrophes of our times. The destruction in Gaza and slaughter of thousands of innocents has cast a dark shadow over the US and its allies, with support for Palestinian self-determination now at an all-time high. With a multipolar world now beckoning, today's live genocide can never be forgiven. The moral argument for Israel's apartheid existence has now been lost, buried in the ashes of Khan Yunis and Rafah.
And with that, I would like to introduce my next guest. Dr. Michael Flavin is a novelist, award-winning short story writer and academic. He is reader in global education at King's College London and has authorised 6 books with a 7th due out later this year. His debut novel, One Small Step, was set in the Irish community in Britain at the height of the Troubles and is also the author of academic articles on leadership and Irish republicanism, published in the journals Terrorism and Political Violence and in Small Wars and Insurgencies. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, I'd like to speak about your first novel, One Small Step, that is set in one of the most volatile periods of the Troubles, but in England, and investigates the experiences of the Irish diaspora in England. Do you want to speak a bit about that, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, just to put it in context of that population, I mean, there'd been waves of emigration to the British mainland from Ireland for economic purposes for a long time. My parents came over here at the back end of the 1950s because work was plentiful. You know, my father got a job as a bus driver. And there was quite an established Irish community in Birmingham where we lived at the time. You know, we all went to Mass on Sunday and the holy days of obligation. We went to the same primary schools. You know, you could look down the register and see Irish name after Irish name. We had the annual St. Patrick's Day parade in Birmingham City Centre, which had been going since 1952. You know, you'd walk into another kid's house and the Sacred Heart picture would be above the fireplace and the holy water font would be by the door. You could live as an Irish person in Britain fairly contentedly. But of course, the mood music around Irishness in Britain changed first with the conflict itself at the end of the 60s, and then that accentuated when the IRA began its mainland bombing campaign around 1973-74.
You speak about that in the novel, that backlash that there was towards the Irish community. How was that experience for yourself as a child?
I think we have to accept that there's a unique case element about Birmingham, because of course it was the site of the Birmingham pub bombings, 21st of November 1974, coming up for its 50th anniversary, in which an IRA unit acting without authorization from higher up the chain of command left 2 bombs in 2 Birmingham pubs, which killed 21 and injured over 180. It's pretty much instantaneous. Now, in my case, as a primary school child wearing my Catholic school uniform, I'm suddenly getting beatings on the way home from school, but I'm a primary school child. I haven't the faintest idea why that's happening. I mean, if we look at then other historical accounts of that period, we see that Irish workers were being sent home from work because they were at risk of attack from their colleagues. We see that people in Birmingham with Irish accents were being refused service in shops. People trying to pay with checks drawn against Irish banks were having them refused. Market traders in Birmingham's Bullring Market refused to handle Irish goods. The backlash was real. The backlash was substantial. The Irish centre in the Digbeth area of Birmingham got attacked. Some Catholic schools got attacked. It was like that. you know, the sudden switch from being tolerated to being attacked as a community. And it was, of course, you understand that there was a reaction, but the nature of reactions is that they are reactionary. And, you know, I mean, it reaches its apex then with the miscarriages of justice case. And, of course, in our case, the Birmingham Six are right at the forefront of that.
That's something I'd like to explore. I mean, you had the Guildford Four, the Birmingham Six, the Maguire Seven. How was that period? I mean, did things ease for the Irish community then, or did things become worse?
It was certainly, there's no question it was fearful. I mean, one anecdote I draw up and use in One Small Step is that we had a vinyl record at home called Songs of Irish Resistance by a guy called Hugh Traynor. And it had the, you know, the kind of classics of the repertoire. It had The Boys from the Old Brigade, Nation Once Again. After the bombings, that went missing from the house. My mum and dad clearly got rid of it. They were frightened of the next knock at the door. A work colleague of my father's who did benefit dances for the families of internees, you know, post-August 1971, there was internment without trial here in the north of Ireland. And he was taken in. You know, the Prevention of Terrorism Act was passed a week after Birmingham. It was a scary time to be Irish in Birmingham. If you look at the Birmingham Six, I mean, there was actually five of them that were travelling. The sixth one had waved them off at Birmingham's New Street Station and gone back to his council house in Aston. But when the five who were travelling back to Belfast were stopped, they were subjected to a forensic test which indicated that two of them had been handling explosives. Now, for laboratory, for scientific knowledge standards, that test should have been repeated, but wasn't. As soon as that result was produced, they were treated appallingly badly, terrible violence. I'd recommend any of your viewers and listeners to go to Chris Mullin's book, Error of Judgment, for the fine-grained detail on this barbaric process. But three of them did confess to a crime they didn't do. Two of them never confessed. And when it comes to court, there are all kinds of things that are manifestly wrong. The statements talk about taking the bombs to the pubs in plastic bags, but the test of the explosion site shows they were in suitcases with D-handles. And the places where they say they planted the bombs are not where the bombs were. And yet, nonetheless, they get convicted on what the judge, later ennobled, calls the clearest and most overwhelming evidence I've ever heard. Now, it took a long and thankless campaign to get them out. But if we look at that, and we look at the Guildford Four, one of whom was a teenage girl and not even Irish, if we look at the conviction of Judith Ward, if we look at the Maguire Seven, the youngest of those children convicted was 13 years old and scarred for life by his prison experiences, Patrick Maguire recorded in his book, My Father's Watch. I mean, this was a terrifying time to be Irish in Britain. And you had the sense that, okay, they happened to latch on to those Irish men, but if it hadn't have been those, they'd have found others. And I think from having been quite a settled and contented and hardworking immigrant community, it became a fearful and somewhat paranoid Irish community for quite a long period of time, certainly into the 1990s.
This would have been a period when you had a lot of tradesmen building the economy of Britain at the time. I mean, if we're talking about builders, tradesmen, bricklayers, there would have been vast employment throughout Britain at the time. And obviously this would have been badly affected. But I'm sure it also had an effect on the economy at the time also. Has there been any research into that, or has it been spoken about in much detail?
It's under-acknowledged and under-researched. Yeah, I think if we look at that post-war phase in Britain, that economic reconstruction, first of all, you got all the building work, and Irish labour is central to that building work. Then if we think about the National Health Service, introduced at the back end of the 1940s, a tremendous amount of Irish people work in the National Health Service. If we look at the transport systems in Birmingham, London, Glasgow, Liverpool, Manchester, elsewhere, the extent to which Ireland contributes to rebuilding the British mainland in the post-World War II phase is vastly underappreciated and underrecorded. And I think there's a fascinating seam of history and social history that's yet to be fully excavated on that subject.
Yeah, and which made me think about the, you know, the underground system, subways and tunnels. Mm. I mean, the vast majority of those were built by Donegal men in a small concentrated area in the Rosses, beside Dunloe, the Donegal Tigers, but that's a whole episode on its own.
Mm.
But on that, there's something of an anathema around the slogan, no blacks, no dogs, no Irish. Now, there's no doubt that we had this campaign against the Irish community in England at the time. But how valid is that? I've seen online, and I've been responsible for myself, for sharing images that have been photoshopped. Is that something that you experienced or seen yourself?
No, it isn't. And when you talk about you broadcast it also, I've spoken about this in other fora, and you see the virulence of the below-the-line comments that people care about this. It's become something of a shibboleth, or almost a truism, that these signs were there. But if we're looking at the level of academic knowledge production, where we can triangulate evidence, see it from more than one source, establish that it's there, I regret to say we don't have it. That's not the same as saying it doesn't exist or didn't exist. But to the level of kind of proof we need, that isn't in the public domain. Now, someone who came over in the 50s or 60s, late 60s, someone may have that historical artifact which demonstrates categorically that it existed. What I will say is it's certainly expressive of a truth. It was harder for black people, for Irish people, to get accommodation when they came over here. And this idea that blacks, Irish, and dogs all being grouped together, well, there was plenty of things said about Irish people. I mean, a quote that I find hard, but is nonetheless, this is demonstrable. After the Brighton bomb of 1984, if you take a look at the Sunday Express of the week and afterwards, the editor, John Juner, later Sir John Juner, writes, and I quote, "Wouldn't you rather admit to being a pig than to being Irish? I am Irish. I am not a pig. Thanks for asking." So there certainly was anti-Irish prejudice, and whether that sign exists, I mean, certainly something I saw at firsthand but didn't photograph was a park near me after the Birmingham pub bombings just had large graffiti on a wall that said, "Irish kill, rubber bullets don't." Now, that happens to be untrue. I think we're looking at 16 or 17 people who were killed by plastic or rubber bullets during the conflict, half of whom were children. My sense is the person responsible for the graffiti wasn't over-interested in historical nuance. Whether or not the no blacks, no Irish, no dogs specifically existed, it is expressive of a broader truth that there was anti-Irish prejudice evident on the British mainland, and that certainly was accentuated, and we certainly experienced it in Birmingham.
Now, I know the difficulties between academic writing and creative writing, and it's something that's quite difficult to navigate. How have you found that yourself within your work?
It's strange because when I, as you say, I've got a background of writing academic books and academic articles. I teach at a university in London. It's part of my professional practice. When I started writing One Small Step, I found it by far the easiest writing project I've ever done. I mean, it sounds like an arrogant statement, but it's just an authentic one. Once I started telling the story of what it was like to be an Irish child in Birmingham at the time of the Birmingham pub bombings, it just flowed. My very few regrets about the process that I didn't write this book 15 years earlier, because I certainly could have done and then been on this journey that much sooner. I think a lot of academic writing is from the outside in. So if I'm writing an article for a journal, I know it has to have a literature review section where I look at what other scholars have said. I know it has to have a methodology section where I describe how I'm going about it so other scholars could come along and replicate the work and find its faults, which is all to the good. So there's a kind of outside-in quality about academic writing, whereas I think the creative process is much more inside-out. You almost have to start on the inside and trust the instinctive truth of what you're writing. And then later, once I had the first draft of One Small Step, I went away and did the academic thing of reading everything I could find on the subject to try and make sure that it was a decent piece of work in terms of its verisimilitude as well, which is not to say I haven't used creative license in places, because I have. Where I've got to with that now is I actually think all the creative writing has loosened me up a little as an academic writer, and I've got a little more confidence to start by writing what I actually think, and then bring the academic rigor to that at some other point. So I think I'm at quite an interesting symbiotic point in my writing, where the two, which started as kind of opposite ends of a polar relationship, are coming closer together. I'd recommend it to other academics, you know, start getting creative.
That's an interesting point you made. So in the creative end, you would write creatively, let the writing flow, and then afterwards use your academic knowledge to go back on what you've already written.
Yeah, I think that the British novelist John Fowles, who wrote The French Lieutenant's Woman, so you almost need that kind of wildness to begin with of just getting it out there, but then you need to come in with all the editing. I mean, anyone who writes creatively, you know, the idea that you just do this one creative splurge and then present your work to a grateful world, be willing to rethink that as a method for creative writing. I think the hard hours are once you've done that, and then you're going back over it as an editor, and you're trying to sharpen meaning, and you're trying to find results, and you send it to trusted readers who know you well enough to tell you when you're wrong. And, you know, there was whole, I mean, I remembered in One Small Step, the first draft had an entire chapter, which was the history of Britain's colonial relationship with Ireland. The first reader I showed it to gave me a very clear retort on that that's not going to work in a novel. And they were right, by the way, 100%. So I think, yes, creative writing is a really fascinating process. And I think, but you do need then to be able to bring that cooler, detached rigor to turn an interesting first draft into a valuable final document.
And looking at some of your other work, you've had a keen interest in looking at leadership within the Republican movement. I mean, basically from partition onwards. Do you want to speak a bit about that?
Yeah, I think leadership's a really interesting area of study because our tendency is with leadership to think of leaders. You know, we tend to individualize it. But I mean, the most fundamental thing we can say about leadership is that it's a social practice. You can't do it on your own. If you or I were marooned on a desert island, we could say, I am the leader. But it's a meaningless statement unless other people are there. So followership is absolutely crucial to leadership, and followership isn't passive. Leaders have to take followers with them, or they can't stay leaders. You lose your credibility. So I've been doing a lot of work in recent years around leadership as a social practice, and I'm finding that Irish republicanism, particularly over the period known as the Troubles, is really, really interesting in that regard. Because if we look at what the IRA and Sinn Féin did over that period, was to take a paramilitary body and to transform it into a political party. And to achieve that transformation while maintaining the coherence and solidity of the organization is really remarkable, because if we look at the history of Irish republicanism, it has been prone to splits. It's the Brendan Behan joke, you know, you put three Republicans in a room and the first item on the agenda is the split. But if we look at what Sinn Féin accomplished over the course of the Troubles, I mean, that's extraordinary to effect that transformation while maintaining organizational coherence. And one, I'm finding it very interesting to write about it. I mean, my most recent academic article in Small Worlds and Insurgencies is called Was Gerry Atoms a Transformational Leader? And I think even more importantly, if we look at what the organization did and look at that academically, we can start to draw truths that we can then say, well, what can we learn from how leadership was and followership were practiced in this conflict that we can usefully and productively and progressively apply to conflicts that are still with us? We really only need to take a very cursory look at the world to see that conflict is on the rise.
There was something that we had talked about earlier which really gave me food for thought, was the Cathal Golding incident where he had brought Johnson over. Mm. And you examine the difference between, you know, the leadership role of Cathal Golding then and in more contemporary times with Gerry Adams and bringing the Republican movement along with him. Do you want to discuss that?
Yeah, I mean, this is really where my scholarly interest comes in, is that the failure of an IRA uprising from 1956 to 1962, Operation Harvest, in the aftermath of that failure, the leader at the time, Cathal Golding, I mean, and a thing to say about this is it's not an unreasonable conclusion to have drawn. But to look at since partition, there'd been attempts at uprisings which hadn't succeeded. So Goulding's thing was, well, there's no point thinking about armed struggle. It's not getting us anywhere. We have to take a more political pathway to this. And it's the 1960s. There's a general leftward drift in progressive thinking. So Goulding brings over Roy Johnston from the Communist Party of Great Britain, and they start to take a much more theoretically driven approach to the conflict. Now, all of this is well and good. But what it does do is detach leader from followers. Goulding is not taking followers with him. There's an edition of the United Irishman in that phase in the 1960s, which criticizes the practice of saying the rosary. Now, there's one regional IRA leader, Sean McStephan, who later becomes a central figure in the formation of the Provisionals, who refuses to sell the newspaper because it's against his own religious values, and he's suspended for a period of time. But that really was an opportunity for the leadership to think, hang on, are we bringing followers with us? Because what happens then when the conflict erupts in the late 1960s, the IRA has not maintained its armaments. It has a leadership that's committed to a political pathway. And when the community looks to the IRA to defend it, it just simply doesn't have the capacity or the inclination particularly to do so, which creates internal dissension leading to the formation of the Provisionals, which is a much more action-driven organization perceiving a need to act in the immediate moment. So I think Goulding's leadership is an interesting kind of micro case study itself of what happens when leaders don't take followers with them. And if we look at what the Provisionals did, and as it became more political, the movement was at times glacially slow. But I think that pace of movement is predicated on the understanding that, look, if you're not bringing followers with you, you're going to lose all credibility and not then have any efficacy either.
Which brings me to your further research into leadership within the NLA and IRSP. Mm. I think that's something that fascinates me, and we will be speaking to someone from the IRSP shortly on the show. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I've currently got an article under consideration which looks at leadership in the IRSP and INLA. If we look at the main leadership figure in that organisation until his killing in 77, Seamus Costello, he forms the Irish Republican Socialist Party in 1974. And it's not without interest. I mean, it takes a very progressive line on women's issues, where I think it has to be acknowledged that one thing about the world of the IRA, it was very male and also very masculine. So I think there was interesting ideas coming out of the IRSP. And back from right then, they were arguing for electoral participation, which again, we see with the IRA and Sinn Féin. You have to wait until 1986 and the decision to contest elections in the Republic and to take seats if elected. So it's not as though it didn't have an interesting political proposition to make, the IRSP. But Costello had cut his teeth in that failed campaign of 56 to 62 and then seeing Goulding's leadership afterwards. And one of the things that it seems to me had frustrated him was precisely that any operatives, any volunteers, had to be answerable to that political leadership, and this was a hindrance on getting anything done. So he gave his arm wing, the INLA, a lot more autonomy so that they could actually act on operations. But that's taking a big risk, because that's a tactic, the operational. But if it's not overseen by the strategic, it just becomes diffuse and contradictory, and people might pursue personal grievances, or people might pursue self-aggrandizement or even self-enrichment. So if those operatives aren't linked to a strategy, how are you going to achieve your aims? So I understand where Costello's frustration in that 62, you know, then as the conflict escalated, I understand where his frustration came from. But I think there was quite a strategic error made in giving so much operational autonomy to the people on the ground, and the politics got lost. And I think the organisationally, it degraded after that.
I'd like to talk about your latest novel, Long Is the Way, which is set in March 1988, another tumultuous period of the Troubles. Do you want to speak a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a period that I find fascinating. It's a very disturbing period in the whole conflict, in that we have, first of all, the SAS killing three IRA active service unit volunteers in Gibraltar. It needs to be pointed out, none of them were armed at the time of their killing. And let's be clear, you don't send the SAS in if you're looking to effect a citizen's arrest. So in the aftermath of that killing, at the funeral itself then, a Milltown cemetery, was attacked, and grenades were thrown and shots were fired, and three further people were killed. And then a matter of a couple of days later, at one of those funerals of the victims there, two British Army corporals accidentally drove into the funeral cortege. The mourners thought they were being attacked again, turned on the corporals and killed both of them. So it's this awful time. I remember I was an undergraduate student at the time following these news events in the mainland, and it looked like the whole thing was going to topple over the brink. You know, civil war looked a real possibility. You know, how can this be stopped? It's just getting worse. And it's a terrible time in the conflict. And yet what we know now that we didn't know then was that these back-channel negotiations that fed forward to the peace process were happening then. Father Alec Reid of the Redemptorist Order at the Clonard Monastery here in Belfast was facilitating meetings between Gerry Adams and John Hume of the SDLP. We know that conversations were happening between Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil in the Republic. So what interests me, I suppose, is this counter-narrative, because on the one level, it's one of the most appalling periods in an appalling conflict, and yet there's this below the surface narrative going on, which actually becomes a component part of what becomes the peace process in the 90s. So those reverse directions of travel are what really interest me, and it's that tension. That's what I'm trying to capture in the new novel. I'm just at the back end of finessing the writing, and hopefully that'll come to publication next year.
So what are we expecting from you in the future? What have you got your eyes set on the horizon?
Okay, well, there's several projects. One, I'm working on another article about the INLA. I mean, the article I've got under consideration at the moment ends in 1992, when the Provisional IRA move against another splinter group from INLA called the IPLO, the Irish People's Liberation Organization. But internal dissension continued to characterize the INLA thereafter. And there was an internal feud, again, resulting in deaths. in the mid-1990s. And again, I want to look at that period and say, well, what was the leadership like? What was the followership like? Because I think if we can identify those failings in leadership and followership, those structural failings, we can actually draw lessons which continue to have use value and aren't just an academic project hermetically sealed in itself. I'm also developing a book proposal to look at leadership in the IRA and Sinn Féin throughout the 30 years of the conflict. There are some fantastic canonical studies and overviews of the Troubles. There are some excellent themed works on the Troubles. So I've been reading one at the moment, Thomas Leahy's book on the intelligence war throughout the conflict. But there's no study of leadership in that period. And because I think it's so critical to the transformation of the conflict, it feels like a really rich theme to explore. I'm also working on another couple of novels. One in particular, I want to revert back to looking at how the Troubles impacted in the United Kingdom. There's a case, it's pretty much forgotten now, of a guy called Kenneth Lennon, who was a special branch tout, an informant, giving information in 1974. It had got too much for him. He was having a bit of a breakdown and starting to tell people, which I think, and next thing his poor dead body was found in a lane near Gatwick Airport in 1974. And you think, well, obviously the IRA caught up with him, he was a tout therefore. But you're left thinking, scratching your head, well, the IRA didn't have that kind of infrastructure in the United Kingdom mainland in 1974. And there were question marks about who really killed this character. And I think I will dramatize that and draw it away from the historical record, which is murky anyway, and think about it in creative terms. But I think I've always felt that if the British public knew the full extent of what went on in this conflict on what is Britain claims British constitutional soil, I think it would disturb the general public really to know the full extent of what's going on. And I think it's important at this stage now, when there's a risk of a rather anesthetic narrative being constructed about the Troubles, those of us who work academically, those of us who work creatively, I think we have to have the courage to be willing to surface uncomfortable truths, not simply for their own sake, but for the learning we can take forward. Because the Irish constitutional question is still unresolved. There have been some really interesting events happening around Ireland's future. There's a lot of pluralistic dialogue that has to draw in all the different communities. And I think if we get this right, there's lessons that can be learned that can have broader geopolitical value, and my goodness, that's needed.
Well, Michael, I could sit and talk to you all day. I'm a big fan of your research, and I'm looking forward to see what you have in the future. I want to thank you again, which is your first time. I've been told your first time in Belfast.
It's been amazing.
Yeah, and West Belfast in particular.
Yeah, I've spent yesterday walking around. Yeah, I mean, it's personally transformational.
Well, listen, you're always welcome. You have my number. I'm hoping to see more of you in the future.
That's great. It's been a privilege to be here. Thank you.
And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across all our social media platforms. I'd like to thank our special guest, Dr. Michael Flavin. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be speaking about a topic which is very important and rarely talked about. I'm speaking about the rights of a student that a teacher should observe. What are these rights? This is the question we want to pose today. You know, usually when rights and obligations are discussed, most often the rights of the superior are discussed and the obligations of the inferior are discussed. For example, they'll say, well, a parent's right is that he should be, respected by his children, and children have the obligation of respecting their parents, not harming them and not hurting them, hurting their feelings. this teacher should be respected. It's his right to be respected by the student. Very rarely are the rights of the, you know, the inferior party discussed. So today we want to look at this this question, obviously, and we will take inspiration from the hadith to answer it. In one beautiful hadith which has been narrated from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, it's been said that he said this: be gentle towards those you teach as well as to those whom you learn from. And this is a beautiful hadith in that the Prophet mentions the rights of both parties, both the teacher and the student, that they should be kind and lenient and gentle towards one another. In another beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam said this. This hadith has been narrated in the famous Risalatul Huquq, or Treatise on Rights of the Imam. The Imam says, the right of your subjects through the knowledge you possess is to know that Allah has made you a custodian over them on account of the knowledge He has bestowed on you and the storehouses of wisdom which He has opened up for you. If you teach people well and do not mistreat them and do not get bored of teaching them, then Allah will increase His grace upon you. But if you withhold your knowledge from people or treat them harshly when they seek knowledge from you, then it will be Allah's right to deprive you of knowledge and its magnificence and to make you fall from your place in the people's hearts. So I guess this is, to sum this up, is we can say that one of the rights of the student is that the teacher should treat them well, treat them kindly, and consider himself as a custodian over them. This is one of the rights of the student upon the teacher. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam also said this: the knowledgeable man must not be harsh when he teaches, and he must not be disdainful when he learns. Right, so this also echoes the same thing. Finally, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said this. He said this with respect to Allah's verse in the Holy Quran: do not turn your cheek disdainfully from the people. The Imam said that people should be equal in your eyes when it comes to sharing knowledge. Meaning, you shouldn't consider yourself, even though the teacher is superior, he should not consider himself superior to the student. He should consider them as his own equal. And this is actually very important because, you know, this also facilitates the increase in the knowledge of the teacher. When he considers his students as his peers and he asks them for their opinion, his own knowledge will also increase simultaneous with his imparting of his knowledge to his students. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the rights of the student to be observed by the teacher in the light of the hadith of the infallibles, alayhim as-salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's parliament speaker says presence of massive crowds at the funeral of Hezbollah's martyred leaders was a testament to the resistance movement's unbreakable popular support. Another Palestinian abducted by the Israeli occupation forces from Gaza dies due to mistreatment and torture in the occupation regime's jails. The United Nations Security Council approves a resolution calling for a swift end to the war in Ukraine, with the U.S. and Russia hailing the move as a significant step toward peace. Hello, everyone, and welcome to World News. Our top story, Iran's parliament speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf says the presence of massive crowds at the funeral of Hezbollah's martyred leaders was a testament to the resistance movement's unbreakable popular support. Ghalibaf praised the power and unity of Hezbollah, stressing that the resistance and commitment to Lebanon's security makes it impossible for enemies to eliminate the movement from the country's political and security landscape. Highlighting Hezbollah's defense against Israeli aggression, he noted the movement's role in maintaining Lebanon's sovereignty. In the past 2 days, there were funeral and burial ceremonies for Nasrallah and another Hezbollah leader, Sayyid Hashem Safieddine, in Lebanon. The two were assassinated by Israel in separate airstrikes months back. A day after Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's funeral in Beirut, people from all walks of life gathered at the burial site of the martyred Hezbollah leader to pay homage to him.
It was a dream for us to see him. It was a dream for us, but we did not wish to see him martyred. We wished to see him alive. He had hoped for this, and congratulations to him. I cannot describe it more than this.
I was present at the funeral of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, and I felt proud